While you're listening, go to archpodnet.com/members and support our efforts. Let's get to the show.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 187.
On today's show, we talk about the history of Glacier National Park.
Let's dig a little deeper into those icy, icy glaciers
that are melting away.
Oh, bye, glacier. All right. Welcome to the show, everyone. How's it going?
Good.
So we are not in Glacier National Park.
No.
But we were a few weeks ago.
We were. It was amazing.
Yes. And I want to preface this entire show by saying we are going to have some inserted audio here, and I'll let him introduce himself, but we took a tour, and It was a native Blackfoot Indian tour guide, And he's got, you know, professional speaking degrees. He was a football player, all these crazy things.
My name is Jack Gladstone. I am the quarterback. No, I'm not the quarterback. I'm the founder of Native America Speaks. I'm a singer-songwriter. I have 15 CDs out over the last 35 years. And that is to my credit, because what I've chosen to do is to interpret through the strongest lyric poetry that I can write. So I will share.
Throughout this episode, we're going to be dropping in things that he said with his permission. We talked to him before we did the tour, said we were going to record a bunch of stuff. So keep that in mind, too. We are on a tour bus. Sometimes we're outside.
Yeah.
The audio isn't perfect. I've done my best to clean it up, but it's really interesting, and we wanted you guys to hear some of this. But We can't recommend enough that if you go to Glacier National Park, do the Sun Tours tour, because there are the Red Bus Tours, and I'm sure those are great, and the Red Buses are really cool and
it's
antique.
Iconic, yeah.
It's very iconic. But the tour guides aren't, you know, they're not native tour guides.
No.
You know, you're going to get good history and stuff. You're going to get some good things. But I don't know. I feel like just getting it from somebody whose ancestry is that park.
Yeah.
And those mountains and that area and the plains, you know, is just something different.
Yeah. It just felt really cool to have his cultural perspective added into the tour, because he knew plenty about the park and the area and the geology and the ecology and all of it. He knew a lot about that stuff. But then he also had his cultural knowledge that he was able to share with us throughout the tour, too. And that was really special.
So we are going to talk about a few things. And like I said, we will mix in some of what he said with some of what we're saying. Mm-hmm. And hopefully you learn a lot about this amazing place.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the culture, history, and people that are from, or, you know, I guess their ancestry is from the Glacier National Park area.
Yeah. And like you might expect in basically anywhere in this country at this point, there's evidence of human activity going all the way back 10,000 years. So people were in that area, the mountains, the valleys, for a really long time.
Now, to hit on that real quick, you may have heard us say something about evidence of human activity in North America going back 14, 15,000 years. There's some evidence back 20, 25,000 years, potentially. The reason this probably only goes back about 10,000 years because it was literally under glaciers.
It was. Yeah. These areas were revealed by glacier retreats, you know, around 10,000-ish years ago, probably, which is why that's when we see the first human activity.
I like to think that there could have been people walking over the top of this on top of the glaciers at some point, like a mile up. Yeah. Because they were super deep.
Very well, could have been. And there's been some news recently about like glacial archaeology where archaeologists are just like watching the glaciers melt away like looking for archaeology that it leaves behind from people dropping stuff on top of the glacier or human activity underneath the glacier that is being revealed now. So glaciers are, they are like so destructive, but so cool at the same time.
Right.
Grandmother's stories, daddy's fire, now warming the heart of the man. Fantastic odysseys, a request of dreams, part of our first human class. Elders have summoned the auras of hope, remembered and treasured through time. Don't be surprised, this land comes alive when the legends of glaciers survive.
Yeah.
Grey Wolf and Beaver Chief caretake the land. The heart is the sun's a living drum. Owl eyes and eagle wings perfect the view. Where spirit and matter are one. Permit your wings to transcend the things consuming and cluttering life. You're one-on-one with Creator Sun when the legends of glaciers survive. That calls from our home long ago. We're on the knife edge of time. We feel but never quite know. Youngest of all of her children are us, the ones still learning respect. The soul awakens, the heart is revived, when the legends of glaciers survive. I'll keep the legends of glacier alive. Legend. Legends of Glacier. Legends of Glacier.
Of Glacier. The last, thank you. The last segment of the song, the lyrics, the youngest of all of her children are us, the ones still learning respect. Animals were considered elder brothers and sisters because in the sequence of creation, or the sequence of somebody's version of evolution, you have the fundamental fact that animals were present at the time human beings were gaining consciousness of their own selves. So as elders, they were available for mentorship within the unconscious dream world of which Carl Jung and his archetypes and those themes emerge in human mythology and legend and lore and fairy tales and stuff. And those themes are a real important part of our guidance, because when a young person goes and has his vision quest, both women and men, they are looking for a voice to help articulate wisdom and reason. And that's how the animals came to be so important.
Wow, there obviously was 10,000 years of history of human occupation of this area. But let's just talk about when Europeans arrived and who occupied the area that is now Glacier National Park. And that would be the Blackfeet tribe, which controlled the prairies on the east side of Glacier. And then on the west side, we had the Salish, the Penned d'Oriel, and the Kootenai, who were on the west side where it's more forested. Mm-hmm. As always, forgive our pronunciation.
Yeah.
These words are not English, obviously, so we're doing our best here.
In this country, we have a phenomenon, our Blackfeet, prehistorically and historically referred to as Siksapu. Siksapoot means black wind. Up in the sky, above these mountains, before a Chinook wind, a Chinook wind is a high velocity, 90, 100, 126 miles an hour was a record on top of Logan Pass. It's not messing around. But when the Chinook wind comes in the winter time, what it means is the energy off of the Pacific Ocean is driving westerly, southwesterly, and it hits the mountains, and it seems more precipitation falls on the western slopes of the mountains. Of the McDonald Valley is certified rainforest, okay? A whole different picture. And then over the mountain spills this wind. And after cold maker is a term for the winter storm and the power of the winter storms coming from the north. Cold maker would deposit a whole bunch of snow, it would be cold, and then a Chinook wind will hit. It was 50 below one time in Browning. This is within the last 100 years. But and within 24 hours, it was 50 degrees above zero. So that fast of a turnaround, what this meant when the plains were cleared a little bit in splotches, the fescue grass, the rough fescue grass, the native high-protein grass, would be there, and the buffalo would snatch it up in the midst of the winter. Therefore, it is a reprieve from the coldness of winter. Not only would the buffalo eat, but then we'd turn around and eat the buffalo. It's one of the reasons why the Blackfeet had some of the highest consumption of fresh meat year-round, because of the availability or the presence of Siksapoot, the black wind. But in the long ago time, mysteriously, the warm, dry west wind did not come. And as the firewood ran low, as the pemmican, the dried buffalo fat and berry mixture, as that ran low, there was crisis. And when there's crisis in our communities, heroes sometimes step forward. In this case, it was a young orphan boy. He spoke with the animals, and he could communicate with the animals, which a lot of people had lost the ability to do. But he went out into the forest after promising his people he would try to help. "Oh, my animal elders," he says, Pokesaput. And then down came the owl, seepy style. And then down came magpie, caw, caw, landed. And then weasel, and then coyote. Coyote is a little wolf. And he said, "Does anyone know what's happened to the Chinook wind?" Magpie spoke up, "Caw, caw." He said, "I know what happened. A big grizzly bear stole the Chinook. He put it into an elk skin bag, and now he's sleeping in his lodge." Oh, the boy said, "Well, I'm going to go find that bear and capture the wind back from him." This is the story of the recovery of one such wind. This is called The Bear Who Stole the Chinook. Everybody give me a big growl right now for the bear. The snow came early and they hung deep. The cold blown bitter made the women weep. Our men tracked hard, but could find no game. Within our children's bellies were crying pain. My elders gathered in the evening dawn. They prayed and waited and looked. But little did they know that way up high, the bear had stole the Chinook. Everybody say, the bear had stole the Chinook. Well, a ragged orphan boy living alone called to the animals in his home. Owl and magpie flew on in. With coyote and weasel, there was four of them. As their council met, the magpie called as their hero shivered and shook. He said, "My relatives told me so." He said, "The bear has stole the Chinook." Sing, "The bear has stole the Chinook." Our hero's journey to release the wind turned west to the mountain bear's den. For days they teamed and traveled apart. Together they did ascend up to the den that held the Chinook. The grizzly snored and snarled in his sleep. listen to his lodge, Pete. Everybody now. They're punch down size with a stick. So they send in a brother who's lightning quick. The weasel slithered easy through the hole and found the elk skin bag of the crook. The bear enraged wrote, go away. And the bear said, everybody, bear voice now. I'm the bear who stole the Chinook. One more time. I'm the bear who stole the Chinook. Then our friends made medicine smoke appear and blew it in the grizzly bear's den. The big old grizz fell fast asleep as Kyle crept on in. He found the bag where the wind was kept, pulled it to the light of day. There were prairie chicken picked the stitches up. Now the prairie chicken was a consultant, and the American Indian sign talk for consultant is this. Then the Chinook blew on its way. The Chinook blew on its way. Everybody bring in the wind now. Bear burst suddenly from his sleep. Bear said, our friends all fled their job complete. The bear in vain pursued the wind. Oh, but the warm wind never was again his friend. Now bear sleeps underground the winter long in his lodging rooms and looks back to the days of the winter warmth. Everybody, to the bear who stole the Chinook. Bigger, to the bear who stole the Chinook. Okay, I'm the bear, everybody. I'm the bear who stole the Chinook. One more time. I'm the bear who stole the Chinook.
And now today, the Blackfeet Indians have a 1.5 million acre reservation on the east side of Glacier National Park, and they have approximately 8,600 members.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big reservation, and I believe it is the biggest in Montana.
Right. Yeah, it is. It is big. And the interesting thing is there is also a Glacier National Park up in Canada.
There is.
Just to the north of here. There's a little kind of like middle park that crosses the border that's controlled by both Canada and the United States, right at the north end of Glacier and the south end down there in Canada. Not the south end of their Glacier National Park, but just this area.
Yeah, they don't call it Glacier National Park. It's Waterton, which we'll talk about a little bit more in
a
second.
But they also have a Glacier National Park that's up in the mountains north of Banff.
Yeah, when you're looking at the national parks, just make sure you're distinguishing between the two.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah, so I just wanted to point out that, you know, we're so close to Canada over here. Obviously, the Blackfeet Indian tribe was across borders and you know, really big, and whatever the Canadian side is called, you know, the ancestry is all shared.
So on the west side of Glacier, there is the Flathead Indian Reservation, and that encompasses approximately 1.3 million acres, and it's mostly along the Flathead River, and it's home to approximately 7,000 members. Now, this one is the Confederated Salish Kootenai Tribes. So this would be, I guess, all the tribes on the west side sort of came together and formed like one confederated group, and that is the Flathead Reservation.
Right.
So that's how that works. So yeah, that would be the people that occupied the Glacier area when Europeans entered the picture. And our tour guide was a member of the Blackfeet tribe. And yeah, they have some really amazing cultural history for that area.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's take a break and come back and talk about a little bit of history about the park. Hey everyone, Chris Webster from the APN here. We have used a number of solutions for recording our podcast with interesting people from around the world. None have worked better than Zencastr. For the last several years, we've been using Zencastr for high-quality recordings that are easy to do and put little to no stress on the guest. And now, Zencastr has high-quality video and even automatic transcription. So click the link in the show notes or head over to zencastr.com/pricing and use the code TAS to get 30% off your first 3 months of the Pro Plan. If you're starting a podcast anytime soon, it's totally worth it. Again, click the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months. And they even give a little back to us when you do.
Keep this conversation going by joining our members-only Slack team. There's always vibrant conversations going on over there between members and hosts about the topics we're podcasting about and more. Also get access to our back catalog of bonus material and ad-free shows. You get all this for $7.99 a month or less than $80 US per year if you get the annual subscription. Support archaeological education and outreach by supporting the APN. Go to archpodnet.com/members for details. That's archpodnet.com/members.
Are you listening to this podcast and thinking you'd like to start your own podcast and don't know where to start? Well, Chris Webster, that's me. I'm founder of the APN, and I started podcasting back in 2011. You can learn from my years of experience, and you can do it at your own pace. Head over to propodcastnow.com and click the Learn to Podcast image. My 6 to 8 hour self-guided course will take you from show inception to your first episode, and you'll learn the tools you need to keep it all going and prevent pod fading. That's a real term. You can have access to the materials for as long as you want, and if you stay in for 3 months at least, you'll have lifetime access to the graduates' Slack team so you can talk to other people that have taken the course and are managing their own podcasts. Again, head over to propodcastnow.com and click Learn to Podcast. Welcome back to the Glacier National Park Archaeology Show. And we are focusing all on Glacier National Park in the United States.
Yes.
And now we're going to talk a little bit about the history of the park, you know, what kind of led to its development, mm-hmm. you know, who was there first. And as with all things in either Canada or really like the Northern Plains and Northern, you know, what became the United States, it's all about
the beaver. It's this that we cross over into the Columbia River Basin over the top of Logan and we go down to a big bend there. We are in an area that did not have a firm claim on it until the Lewis and Clark Expedition. 1804, 1806, 1803 was the Louisiana Purchase. And in their zeal, what they would do, Thomas Jefferson and Captain Lewis met and discussed this. How do you claim something? How do you have a legitimacy? You have diplomatic relations with the indigenous peoples, with the natives. Also, you make the best maps you can make. Clark was a hell of a great map maker. We could talk a whole lecture on that. We also had to also consider Clark didn't see everywhere he was making a map. He sat down with Indian elders and they were drawing pictures in the sand and pictures in the dirt in order to have a glimpse with that. And ultimately, some specimens were taken of animals and just meticulous journals, the best they could do. And it was also probably the most valuable player on one level was Sacagawea. Sacagawea, we perhaps call her. But Sacagawea, bird woman, portrayed exactly what she was, a mother with a child, still nursing, as a matter of fact. And our warriors, when we checked out this, you know, this special forces group, our warriors didn't think, boy, never would they bring a woman and a child along on the expedition. But this is a song called the Lewis and Clark Cora Discovery Rag. A lot of people don't know that Lewis and Clark were entertainers and they wrote some songs. This one is the number one song on the colonial charts back in 1807. The Louisiana Purchase opened up some doors to finance those Napoleonic wars. The deal of the century, but what do we do with it now? The Mississippi drainage ain't exactly hay. At least that's what Thomas Jefferson said one day. A whole lot of room to trap and chop and plow. And there just might be a Northwest Passage somewhere up there. But we gotta beat the French and the British too. Corner that fur trade, yeah, we gotta do it. So he called me up, one for two to stight, and asked me if I'd try with all of my might to put my place in history in the bright. I said, you bet, I then called on Clark. Together we were ready to make our mark. Lewis and Clark, Cora Discovery Rack. Okay, repeat after me in your best enthusiastic voice. Yeah! of all the groups that have ever attempted that, you are one of them. Well, $15 million seem fair for an 800,000 mile, too early, mile square, a tract of land that nearly doubled America's size. So Tom gave us $2,500, pointed up the Missouri and said, good luck, it's where this country's economic future lies. Yes, and politics and money followed us most all the way. At the head of the Missouri, we found three rivers. We named them after Madison, Gallatin, and Jefferson. We boldly go where no one dares. We fight off mosquitoes and grizzly bears. We're really something, though we don't mean to brag. We made friends with all kind of tribes that before the Blackfeet would take our jive. With Lewis and Clark, Cora Discovery will open up the West. Wouldn't it be lovely, the Lewis and Clark, Cora Discovery ride. One last point before I have
to. So the first Europeans into the Glacier National Park area in the early 1800s were... They were trying to trap beaver, right? Yep. Like, that's what they were doing at that time. Yep. The area was still really dominated by the Blackfeet Indians, though. And I think that they sort of, like, got along for the most part. The trappers did their own thing over here. The natives were over here doing their own thing. I mean, that obviously didn't last because Glacier National Park is national park territory now, and it's not part of the reservation. So anyway, there's various treaties and things that happened through the 1800s and early 1900s to get us to the place where we are now, where we have this national park in the mountains. Mm-hmm. Following the trappers, we started getting more European descent folks out there doing homesteading.
Human Rowe was a Hudson's Bay Company man. He was, I think, Scottish or something. But he worked for the Hudson's Bay Fur Company. They had their outpost in 1814 in Edmonton, Alberta. That is almost 500 miles directly to the north. And that was the furthest northern expanse and northern expansion of our Blackfoot Indian Confederacy. The Blackfoot Indian Confederacy, look at it holistically now, there are four divisions. The northernmost is the Siksika. Siksika means Blackfoot. And in Canada, there's two more. The Apatosipikani, which is a northern scabby robes. Scabby robes is a term that is given to buffalo when they are molting in the early summer, the late spring, and they are shedding their winter coat. Just to the north of the border, there is the Kainai. The Kainai are the blood division. I would say if you were talking about Greece, the Kainai would be like the Spartans. They weren't huge, but they were ferocious fighters. Canada did not come into being until 1867, 2 years after the Civil War was over. Canada did not start out as a country. Canada started out as a company, the Hudson's Bay Company. And you may be surprised to learn that 200 years ago, no, 200 years ago, over 200 years ago, the time of the Louisiana Purchase, this was claimed under the international legal principle of the Doctrine of Discovery. That's where the Pope told all Christians in Europe, hey, you claim it, it's yours. If you were a Christian, a monarch, or you were a nation, you could claim any continent, any island, any drainage on the face of the earth if and only if it was not already occupied by Christians. That's the basis for all property rights in the New World. According to an 1823 decision, Chief Justice John Marshall, the U.S. Supreme Court.
Tourism really started taking off when the railroad tracks were built over the Marias Pass through the mountains there. They were completed in 1891. So homesteading followed the trappers, basically. These would be the European descent folks moving out to just, you know, live on the land out there.
And homesteading is the kind word for Europeans and I guess what would have been Americans at the time.
Early Americans. Yeah.
White people coming in and taking land that didn't belong to them.
Very true. They just found a plot of land that they liked and built a home there and lived off the land, basically, yep. whether the native folks liked it or not. So, yeah, that happened. In 1891, the Great Northern Railway built tracks across the Marias Pass. Mm-hmm. When those were completed, that really allowed both homesteading and more people moved out to live, but also tourism really started taking off in this area.
Yeah. Yeah. And in 1892, some guys named Milo Apgar and Charlie Howe, they were offering rental cabins in the area. They had meals, pack horses, guided tours, boat trips for visitors. And in fact, the Apgar Visitor Center, which is one of the bigger visitor centers at Glacial on the west side. Mm-hmm. And we went there and it was huge. Yeah. And there's a whole like Apgar area. That's all named for him.
There was a chalet originally built there by the Great Northern Railroad. Initially, James J. Hill, Minneapolis, St. Paul, was a, I don't know, I can't really call him a robber baron. I don't know that much about him. But he did independently, privately finance the Great Northern Railway all the way from Minneapolis, St. Paul to Seattle, Washington. And then he actually extended a line to Chicago in there also, without using the land grant, the checkerboard squares, claiming this public and private. So it was James J. Hill's son, Lewis, who was the kind of the entrepreneur in thinking, how do we make our railroad pay? And he says, they ducked right to the south of Glacier, what is now Glacier Park. And it was that road, and it was the fact that these look, heck, as much like the Swiss Alps, maybe more like the Swiss Alps than the Swiss Alps are supposed to look. It was see America first. Instead of people, you know, taking off on vacation to Austria in Europe or Switzerland or the Italian or French Alps, they could stay in the United States, take the Great Northern Railway in, and then have a superlative experience. Horseback riding, these chalets were built about one day's ride apart. All the way, Many Glacier, there is Two Medicine, there's, anyway, these added up, and these turned out to be real popular. However, the weather is going to get you unless you build to last 1,000 years. And most of that is building solid foundations with stone or brickwork, and you have conscientious maintenance of it. They built these, and there's only the Two Medicine Chalet is still there. It's a grocery store they built onto it. And also Granite Park Chalet at the end of the High Line. I'll talk more about that. Sperry Park Chalet or two others. Yeah, all the others are pretty much deteriorated or blown to pieces.
The west side is like traditionally more popular, I think, because it is more wooded and you're really like camping in the trees or on the lake or whatever.
Well, I feel like it's easier to get to, too, from
the west area. Yeah, totally. But I'll tell you what, we stayed on the east side, and I love that, like, prairie, like just abruptly ending into a giant mountain look. Right, and it's and you're right there at that nook, like, right where the prairie meets the mountain. It's just such a cool area. So, experience both of them, I guess, is what I'm saying.
We were in the St. Mary's area and St. Mary's Lake.
Yeah.
And there's a whole like rock formation about St. Mary right next to the lake.
Oh, yeah, right. That's what it's named after.
See this mountain right in front? That is the head of St. Mary's, or at least the interpretation of Father De Smet, a Catholic priest who in the 1840s came out and he said, there's an earlier portion to the story. There's a head, there's a body called Flat Top, and at the end of Flat Top, there's about a 1,500-foot straight fall that is called Knoppy Point. Taken all together, that is the Madonna of the lake. And from a particular angle, it looks somewhat like a woman's head laying down with the evergreen forest being the veil up there.
So on the west side, on Lake McDonald, which is that big lake that's right there along the Going to the Sun Road in the park, and it's sort of that iconic image of like the rainbow rocks in the water, that's Lake McDonald. And the Snyder Hotel was the first like hotel built. And originally you couldn't even like get there by car. You had to take a steamboat. Yeah. Which is crazy.
And the cool thing is like it's way up the lake too.
Yeah.
It's, it's near the end of the lake. Yeah. I guess that would be the northern end of the lake. And it was just obvious. We didn't know that when we first went to that hotel because we stopped in just because we were on our little driving tour when we first started. And it looked like we were literally walking in the back door.
It
like
did.
There's a small door in the back.
Yeah.
And you can get into the middle lobby there, the really nice grand entrance there.
With the most amazing fireplace ever. Yeah. And even though it's the middle of summer and the fire wasn't going, it still smelled like fire. It was amazing.
It was a constant wood smell in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the entrance is on the other side because that's where the fancy guests were being, you know, greeted from the boat. So it's cool that they've just never really changed that.
Yep. Totally. Glacier National Park obtained its national park status in 1910, and that, as you can imagine, is when tourism just like
took off,
really boomed.
Yeah.
And because of the tall mountains and the snow-capped peaks and all that, it was called America's Switzerland, and so all the hotels and chalets are in this like Swiss lodge style. And most of them were built in the 1910 to 1915 time frame, too. Mm-hmm. And then also these little guys called chalets, which were
not that little,
but smaller than the hotels. And most of them you had to like take a pack horse or hike to. You still do today. And some of them you can, if you're a backpacker and you like to overnight, you can go and stay at these chalets that were built 110 years ago. It's really cool.
So a cool thing to do that would be that I really want to do that's all based on train travel is the same thing they did up in Canada. So when that railway went across Canada, we saw the Lake Louise Hotel.
Yeah.
And the Lake Louise Hotel is a very similar thing. It's a Swiss chalet style hotel. Mm-hmm. And the railroad up there actually built all these uber fancy hotels all across Canada to encourage people to take railway trips and then to go to these hotels. Well, the same thing happened here. And there's actually a whole series of hotels, not just in Glacier National Park, but across the United States that were built by this railroad in order to get people
to
go out there and do it.
Yeah.
And a lot of these are in national parks now. And they're in, you know, nice places like that. But
yeah,
I mean, it's not like the train tracks go right through Glacier either. It's still kind of a hike from the train tracks.
It is. Yeah. Like the train tracks go along the south end of the park, I think.
Yeah.
We stayed at a park outside, an RV park outside, and we could see the train tracks from there, right? When we were down on the south end. So
we could hear them.
Yeah. Sure. Now, they could take a different path today than they did, you know, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
No, you don't think so?
Probably not. Yeah. It would have been tough to get through Glacier.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. They would have had to go south of those big mountains.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of that, like to go through Glacier today, you have to take the Going to the Sun Road, which is basically built into the side of a mountain.
Yeah.
And there's even points where you can see like these stone arches that are holding up the foundations of the road. And there's pictures of them building those stone foundations, gosh, like from 100 years ago or something like that. It's a really cool road, but it's definitely... It was treacherous to build, and it's treacherous to drive today. Even it's very skinny.
Yeah,
no RVs. We didn't take our RV on that road.
No, not only are there shorter tunnels, two tunnels, I think.
I think there's two of them
on the
yeah.
west side, and then the corners.
Yeah,
like, if your vehicle's too long, it just won't make it. Some of those tour buses are kind of at the limit.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
but beautiful drive though.
Yeah,
very beautiful. So the Glacier National Park, like you mentioned, it goes all the way up to the Canadian border, where it meets a Canadian park on the other side called Waterton Park. And that's why if you get your little brochure about Glacier National Park, it actually says Waterton Glacier on it. And it's the International Peace Park World Heritage Site, which is a mouthful. But basically in 1932, the U.S. and Canada, they joined the two parks to create this international thing going on. Now, if you want to go between them, you still have to have a passport. You still have to go through customs. I think there might be like a special customs just for crossing between the parks.
Unless you're a bear or a fish.
Unless you're a bear or a fish.
Yes.
Then, yeah, you still have to, you know, obey the border rules, but it's kind of cool that they are technically a joint park that is shared by the two countries.
Yeah, there's a whole lake, Waterton Lake, separate, like crosses the border there.
Yeah,
so they have to kind of watch that.
They do.
Yeah,
and also there's a beautiful hotel. I don't know if that hotel was built, like you were saying, as part of the railroad construction in Canada.
I don't know,
but it's another beautiful Swiss style hotel. There's so much old gorgeous architecture and construction to check out.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Okay, well, let's take a break and come back on the other side and talk about the parkeology.
Oh my God.
The song here is called Hudson's Bay Blues. I mentioned my great-great-grandpa was a Hudson's Bay Company man. That's how came into here. And the Hudson's Bay Company introduced the market. Talk about Wolves of Ice and Snow and the power of the market and turning everything into commodities. And anyway, this is what happens when the Garden of Eden was functioning pretty well. And then the snake showed up in terms of the Hudson's Bay. Well, I was riding on my pony, hunting bison on the plains, when the moccasin telegraph reported something strange. Someone building lodges made with stone and logs. They had bushes on their faces and funky looking dogs. Loading off big bundles, triple wide canoes full of trading items, out of sight. Creation sang the blues. Tomorrow's our grand opening. Grab your robes and furs. We'll wheel and deal and feast and drink until you engines purr. We didn't know shopping. We didn't know shop. Call and response now, one more time. We didn't know shopping.
We didn't know shopping.
We didn't start shopping.
We didn't start shopping.
We couldn't go shopping until the Hudson's Bay Company. With horses and dogs up and piled high with skins, it was unfamiliar territory we had wandered in. Bushy-faced Napiquans that said we'll smoke and drink. As we prepared our sacred pie, the Napiquans just winked. When the smoke was over, they said, we've got a gift for you that'll fill your head with visions, make you strong and happy too. Didn't quite know what to think before we drank that rum. It was fire, water, devil, starter, rabbit on the run. Got us ready for shopping. Yeah, we were ready for a shop. Come on.
Ready for a shopping.
Ready for shopping. The Hudson's Bay Company. We wanted flip-flops, wool socks, coffee beans, denim jeans, iron awls, musket balls, powder horns and pretty shawls, blankets, buttons, bolts, flannel, silver bells, tallow candles, sugar flour, dark molasses, colored peats, looking glasses, pale ale, gin and brandy. Fine wine and hard rock candy. Ride through the service was awful handy. Oh, we couldn't stop shopping. Oh, we wouldn't stop shopping. We wouldn't stop shopping. Couldn't go shopping to the Hudson's Bay Company. But 1 week ago, I was walking up and down the aisles of Costco when I looked up to my right and noticed before I left there were mountains of merchandise, and to my left, still more mountains of merchandise. Before long, I realized once again I too had become a victim and a beneficiary of the shopping culture. You know what? Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, cowboys and Indians, in the 21st century, Kmart, Walmart, Target, Shopko, Sam's Club, yes, even Costco.com are nothing more than fur trading posts on steroids. Now we have spandex, Gore-Tex, Nike hairs, gummy bears, ceiling fans, frying pans, turkey veal, shrimp or spam, sales cycle, sports rackets, rollerblades, team jackets, keyboards to surf the net, on a tidal wave of debt, MasterCard, Visa card, Christopher Columbus card. Wait, the first one to say it pays. Christopher Columbus was the first one to say it pays to
discover.
American Espresso, Lord. Every kind of car can't stop shopping. Oh, we can't stop shopping. We can't stop shopping. We can't stop shopping at the Hudson's Bay Company.
What do you use for appointment and task scheduling? I used to constantly move things around in my calendar that were just tasks I needed to do in favor of meetings. Now I let an intelligent AI do that with motion. In motion, all I have to do is create tasks with a soft or hard deadline, state how long I think it will take, and whether it can be broken up, and motion does the rest. It puts the task where it's a best fit for me getting it done by the deadline. The scheduler then puts appointments with people wherever they schedule and moves the tasks around them. Support the APN with a little kickback if you sign up and try motion for free at www.arcpodnet.com/motion. That's arcpodnet.com/motion.
Did you know we have lots of great shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network? Head over to arcpodnet.com and you can see all the shows that are currently producing podcasts. Scroll down a bit more and you'll see some great shows from the past that still have great content. Search for your favorite shows on your podcasting app or listen right on the page at arcpodnet.com.
Welcome back to episode 187 of the Archaeology Show, and we're going to talk about some of the cool stuff they've found and things they've learned at Glacier National Park now.
Yeah, totally. And as you might imagine, the archaeology there is pretty typical of what you find in any area, right? Like, there's a bunch of prehistoric sites. There are homestead sites that have been excavated and all that kind of thing.
Reaching deeper into what is called mythos, ancient, original, sacred, early words of humankind, you look for the metaphors and the connections of meaning. And the wolves, whatever they wish for, they say, Ponoka Puksuput, Imita Puksuput. Whatever they wanted to come out of the ice, they would affirm, and then they would do the work. In other words, you don't expect a doctor degree for sitting on your tail and not going to school, you know. Anyways, Napi saw this and how the wolves worked together. Wolves did things together that they could not do by themselves as human beings, what enabled human beings to become what they are today. Napi begged the wolves, please, I want this power too. Show me your song. Show me your dance. And I take that as the principle of affirmation, the principle of working through problems and accomplishing big things. Did that, and the wolves weren't too crazy about it, but that Napi never misuses power, for it can be removed. And then Napi went out and started just laying waste to the world, wasting a lot, slaughtering a bunch of buffalo and bringing them out of the ice, manifesting darkness instead of light. And the story goes on where Napi is found out by the wolves, and the wolves take their crystalline river of ice to the sky. Pull the rug out of under. Napi wakes up shivering, his teeth are chattering. He looks up and he sees that crystalline sign. I'm going to do the song. I didn't sing it down there. I'm going to do it right now. This is Wolves of Ice and Snow. It's also what we call the Milky Way. It's called the Wolf Trail by the Blackfeet.
The day was young, the sky full of sun. Crystal rivers shivered in the earth's backbone. An old man heard the comforting words of the wolves singing high, dancing low. Songs were sung, dance was spun. Steps aligned in rhythm, given path to grow. In humble face, old man was amazed by the wolves singing high, dancing low. There before his eyes he saw a portion of the ice did thaw, and lo, behold, there sprang a buffalo. Upon this occasion, a portion of creation was released in pairs into the world below. Through the blessings of the wolves of ice and snow, old man asked that both song and dance be swiftly given as a gift from wolf to him. him. In trust he received, then left to retrieve for himself more pleasure in the wind. Up and down the backbone, Appy hunted for adventure, soon to find sparkling river frozen in the sun. Upon ice forbidden by an elder's admonition, his gift became unraveled, a promise was undone. Delivered the tense before self-righteous ego triggered trust to decay. Their crystalline river remains clearly to see. As the trail, some call the Milky Way. As you're looking through the jaws of heaven to the stars above, consider the limits of the known. Whenever despair comes, the cycle of the earth and sun, in certain time transitions dusk to clone. Through the blessings of the wolves of ice and snow, we're interwoven with the wolves of ice and snow. The day's still young, the sky's full of sun. Essentially, Nappy, the last verse I really like, humble happenstance. In other words, if we are humble, we are teachable. If we know absolutely that we do not know absolutely, there's that range of error. And you keep humble and you listen to nature.
The thing that I thought was different and unique is they have these things called culturally modified trees.
Yeah.
And while I've heard of this, and we've even seen some kind of similar ones in some of the work that we've done, this I thought was just particularly unique to this area. So they know about them, obviously. And then in 2017, a group of park archaeologists and the Blackfeet Youth Montana Conservation Corps recorded 20 new culturally modified trees.
Yeah.
So they went out there hunting for them and they surveyed a specific area looking for these very specific trees with this modification.
Yeah. So a culturally modified tree in this particular case.
Yeah. It can mean a lot of things.
Trees have been modified by humans for many, many, many generations.
Right.
So, but Native Americans in this area would strip the bark from ponderosa pines to get to the inner layer, which was then harvested as a food source.
I know. Isn't that crazy? So they could boil it, roast it, or even just eat it raw.
I mean, you might think, why would I do that? But we eat like, you know, potatoes, and they're literally buried in the ground.
Yeah.
Somebody pulled that up and said, you know what? This would go great with turkey.
they're like, it's like a fibrous, like pulpy inside bit. And if that's the sort of component that your diet is missing or that you need, then I'm sure that it was a welcome addition to whatever they were eating.
Yeah. I'm just imagining a particularly cold winter and there's like nothing else around. And they're like, that tree is looking real tasty.
Yummy tree.
Real tasty. But I don't know if they were doing pine nuts in this area. In the ponderosa pine, I'm not sure if it produces the kind of nuts you get like pine nuts from, you know, traditionally.
Mm-hmm.
But I just imagine, you know, Native Americans, obviously, and anybody who lives off the land is going to find ways to use pretty much anything around them. And there's going to be a series of trial and error. Somebody's going to eat that red berry and it's not going to be the right red berry.
It won't go well for you.
Yeah. And then somebody else is going to accidentally boil that red berry and turn it into something you can't eat.
Yeah, totally. You know? So the culturally modified ponderosa trees, they have this like oval shaped hole in the bark on the tree, which is how you know that that it's a culturally modified tree. It's this oval-shaped hole in the bark. And that, I mean, they basically would just peel away some of the top and then they could get at the inside. And I think just the natural way they were scooping it out inside made this that the hole that shape.
Yeah.
But there's another kind of tree that they would also strip the bark from, and that would be the Western red cedar. And in this case, they weren't doing it as a food source, but instead to use the outer bark for clothing, baskets, and canoes.
Yeah, you see cedar bark in general, but the Western red cedar, I remember seeing those on one of the shorter trails that we hiked on. Uh-huh. It has this fibrous nature to it.
Yeah.
And it's all, in fact, it was the Avalanche Trail. They got the boardwalk right at the front of the Avalanche Trail.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, some of those were marked as Western red cedars.
They were, yeah.
And it really does look like fiber. You can just rip this off, and then probably you'd have to get it wet or something like that to kind of loosen it up a little bit once you get it off. But then, man, you really could weave that in about anything you wanted to.
Yeah, yeah, totally. It makes sense. And that's why with those, you don't see it the oval hole like you do for the pines. Instead, it's literally stripped from top to bottom all the way around as high as a person can reach and then all the way down to the base. Mm-hmm. So those are, because it's a different species, they just strip them differently, obviously.
In the 1800s, when the Europeans got there, that basically shut down, more than likely because they were probably trading for clothing and fabric and things like that. I mean, why not? It was there, right? They had things the Europeans wanted and, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a lot easier than stripping the bark off a tree and then processing it into fabric and baskets and things.
They're like, wait a minute, this is, just don't buy the blankets.
No, that's not good.
It's true, though.
Terrible.
It's true, though.
It is true.
They didn't know what kind of dangers they were getting into.
That's true.
With some of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, the cool thing is some of these stuff that you can see, I mean, they stopped this 150 years ago, and you can still see evidence of that activity on the trees that are still there.
Mm-hmm. And you basically know when you see it, okay, this happened 150 years ago. Yeah. Like, that's really cool to think about.
Yep.
Glacier has been protected from logging since it was made a park in 1910. So you've got trees that are super old still standing there and haven't been affected by logging. So you can get some trees that are like even way older than the 150-year-old mark that showed this cultural modification to them.
It's crazy they still show that because trees kind of regenerate themselves.
These holes are so
in the ponderosa?
Destructive. Yeah.
But the ones where they're stripping the bark off the Western red cedar, I imagine that bark would grow back eventually.
Maybe. Yeah.
I don't know.
It would be interesting to read like a more scientific version of the paperwork. Most of this information I got just right from the National Park website. Yeah. But it would be interesting to see the more like scientific research behind it and how that does affect it from a science standpoint. So the trees are really important to locate because you can map them and then you can see the migration paths of prehistoric peoples. Mm-hmm. And if you know the age of the tree, then you can get different migration paths based on the age of the trees too.
Sure.
So I thought that was really cool too.
Yeah. And while these trees are still around today, they won't be forever because they're trees.
They're trees. Yeah.
Now, we're going to a park in a few weeks where there's a tree that's like 4,000 years old, but that's an exception to the rule.
That is an exception.
You know.
And species specific too.
Yes.
Like not all species live that long.
No. So it is important that they get out there and they not only find these trees because it might not be easy to spot when you've got a forest and not all of them maybe, you know, had these holes like with the ponderosas and stuff like that. And it might be hard to just kind of suss out which ones of these are. You know?
Yeah, totally. So. Yeah. So humans are humans, right? And yes, we have the Native American culturally modified trees. Mm-hmm. But then we also have the culturally modified trees left behind by the Europeans. And this would be early rangers carving trees with some of them just carve their names into them. Some of them are like winter snowshoe routes and stuff like that. So I don't know. I mean, do those really count as culturally modified trees or are they just, you know, arbor glyphs or something? Or is it all the same thing?
European is still a culture.
It is. It is.
American is still a culture.
So it's just a human that has modified a tree.
I would say they're definitely still culturally modified. It's just whenever that practice is put to an end and then you get a certain distance and time away from it, you know, it becomes history.
Yeah. So one ranger in particular, there's a really, really distinct arbor glyph made by him. It's just his name. It says, his name was Joe Cosley, and it's engraved Cosley, and then below that it says July 10th, and then below that it says 1910.
Nice.
So very, like, specific markings from one person.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Hey, you know what? He doesn't necessarily have to have carved it in 1910. Maybe his kid was born July 10th, 1910, and that's why he put that there. You don't know.
I'm going to start doing fresh carvings into like into trees that have random years on them from 200 years ago.
Yeah, no, they should be like from like 2000 years ago, where it's like basically not possible that it's there.
Or like in the future.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. Time travel. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So another kind of carving you'll see in the tree sometimes is from early cartographers and surveyors. They would carve section marker info into the trees. You know, today we see those metal geological markers for section corners and stuff like that. But this was just like that information's carved directly into a tree.
Sure. Why not? Yep. It's there. That'll be there forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at least it was there long enough for them, right?
Right. Yeah. Humans have always carved into trees. It's easy to do. You can see it. Mm-hmm. I won't mention on this show, but I saw one in Moab. And down, I don't know if you remember it, but it was just vulgar and crazy.
I don't remember that. Oh, that one. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
We won't talk about that. No, message me privately.
It was a very clear modern carving.
Very clear.
It was slightly. Well, anyway, it whatever. We won't go into it.
Yeah.
We've seen some crazy ones, though, because there were arborists on that project in Northern Nevada that we work on. Right. We have worked on in the past, and they were like. Not, I wouldn't say pornographic, but like definitely like some Basque sheep herders getting a little lonely in the woods, carving some naked ladies into trees.
Yes.
I think. I guess. Yeah, we're so assuming.
Much, there's only so much detail you can carve into a tree.
Generally. Yeah. Yeah.
I would love to have seen these when they were fresh because the trees do grow out.
They do.
Pretty quickly.
They do. The bark puffs out. Yeah.
So.
But anyway. Yeah. We've recorded some of those and it's really cool to find them and try to read them or whatever. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Flows and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that fade, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds at all. And Junes and Ferris wheels and dizzy dancing way you feel, and every fairy tale comes real. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show. You leave them laughing when you go, and if you care, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow it's love's illusions I recall. I really don't know love at all. And feel it proud to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. But now old friends are acting strange. They shake their heads and say I've changed. But something's lost when something's gained. In living every day, I've looked at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow
it's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all. I've looked at clouds, everybody sing with me. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds at all. I really don't know clouds.
All right, well, we hope you enjoyed this slightly different version of the Archaeology Show. It was really fun to go on that tour and record some of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And please check out the links to some of Jack's stuff in mm-hmm. the show notes.
Yeah.
He's got some really cool things. It's on Spotify, Apple Music.
Yeah.
You can find it there and just, you know, support a local artist.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really enjoyed experiencing Glacier through his viewpoint. It was really cool.
Yeah. All right. With that, we will see you next time. And next time we have a whole episode dedicated to experimental archaeology.
We do. I'm very excited. I love experimental archaeology.
All right. See you in a week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.archpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This is Chris Webster, founder of the APN and one of the chief editors. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. If you want to keep the conversation going and support us along the way, go to archpodnet.com/members. That's archpodnet.com/members. And thanks for listening.